This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Today, we're going to continue a conversation about food insecurity in light of recent proposed cuts to the SNAP program. SNAP is often referred to as food stamps. The proposal is from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Yesterday, we spoke to Congressman Jim McGovern about the issue, and today we're joined by two people who think about it every day. The first is Vicki Negus, who is a policy advocate with the Massachusetts Law Reform Institute. Vicki, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We're also joined on the line by Shannon Uramchuk, who once relied on SNAP to feed her family. Shannon now helps feed others as a board member at the Food Bank of Western Massachusetts. She also works at the Corporation for Public Management, which helps find jobs for people receiving public assistance. Shannon, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Shannon, let's actually start with you. You are willing to share your story, which we really appreciate, and you know what it's like to rely on SNAP for food. What is that everyday experience like?
So, you know, the SNAP program is such an amazing, wonderful program for Americans all over the country. And the hardship is not so much, you know, getting those SNAP benefits. It's when those benefits are lost or change. You know, there's a change in your benefits or something else drastic happens. And so for my experience, depending on SNAP benefits was really the only way that I could feed my family in the years that I was homeless and struggling to get back on my feet.
So, Shannon, you say it's when you lose something. Can you explain that to us a little bit better? What do you mean by when you lose something, and how does SNAP step in and fill those gaps?
So, what I mean by that is when you are at the very bottom, you have no income, you have no resources, you have nothing, right? At that time, the state and sometimes the federal government, in the case of SNAP, steps in and offers you benefits to get you back on your feet. What sometimes happens is the threshold for any other income is so low that, you know, the minute you start making anything to sort of pull yourself out of that hole, you start losing benefits. So that it's sort of this vicious cycle of, you know, just barely getting by or not getting by at all.
And you lose benefits because your income means that you don't qualify for those benefits anymore?
Yeah, so the idea of SNAP and also, you know, other DTA benefits is to get you back on your feet. So they give you the SNAP benefits to feed your family during the time that you're not working. At the point where you finally start, you know, getting a job and start working, you almost immediately lose most, if not all, of your SNAP benefits pretty quickly. And it's figuring out how to then compensate for that money, really, using a paycheck, a regular paycheck. In my case, you know, I was in shelter. And so when I finally was able to secure work, I had to work on getting out of shelter and getting into an apartment, and then I had housing expenses, and I had utility expenses, and phone expenses, and vehicle expenses, at the same time that my SNAP benefits were being decreased and mostly, within a few months, cut completely. So then I was like, okay, so I have this little bit of money that I've made for my job, and now I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to continue to keep food in the house without the SNAP benefits.
And what did you do?
Food banks, food pantries, because at one point I was receiving, you know, approximately $700 a month in food stamps, food benefits. And I have four children, so it was a family of five. When I no longer received benefits anymore, I had to try to figure out how was I going to use my income, which was probably only twice what my food stamps were originally, and try to figure out how I was going to pay my bills and buy food. So I spent a lot of time at the pantries. I took whatever they would give to us, and I tried to make my food dollars stretch as far as I could.
Thanks
and
for
sometimes
sharing.
There were decisions that had to be made. You know, I'm not going to pay the phone bill this month because I need to buy groceries, and groceries are more important than phone.
So that sounds incredibly stressful, Shannon. And I want to bring Vicki Negus in here, because the thing you're talking about, there's a name for it, Vicki, right? Which is the cliff effect.
The cliff effect, yeah.
So Vicki, tell us about the cliff effect, and tell us what the USDA is proposing to do with SNAP and how it affects that.
Yeah, absolutely. And Shannon, thank you so much for sharing that story, because I think it really gives some great context for the consequences of what this proposed rule from the Trump administration would do. So as Shannon kind of said, there are really strict eligibility limits for SNAP already in place. And the impact of this proposed rule from the Trump administration would make those strict limits even more strict. In Massachusetts, you know, in order to recognize the kind of reality of life for working families who are trying to move ahead and move forward, we know that it's really difficult for working families to do that without a little bit of added benefit to help put food on the table, especially throughout an entire month. So in Massachusetts, you know, we, along with many other states, have a little bit of we have an income limit over which families are not eligible for this program. Mm-hmm. And the Trump administration is seeking to restrict the flexibility that states have and what that limit is. So just as an example, to give some kind of concrete numbers about what that would look like, you know, in Massachusetts, if a family is of three, was earning, a mom and two kids, was earning $27,000 a year. Right now, and under the proposed rule, they would continue to be eligible for SNAP. But if that mom started working a little bit more, just a tiny bit more, and started earning $27,500 in 1 year, they would no longer be eligible for any SNAP benefit. Mm-hmm. And that would put that family at a much higher risk of food insecurity, which has lots of other really bad impacts in addition to just being hungrier.
So $500 of increased income would essentially lead to the entire elimination of the SNAP benefit for a family. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
All right. Now, either Vicki or Shannon, the administration is arguing we are doing this because nutritional assistance, SNAP assistance, is intended to be a temporary program. And when states use these expanded qualifications, people stay on longer than what we should intend with a temporary assistance program. At face value, that is a reasonable aim. And, you know, I ran Catholic Charities for the Archdiocese of Boston. We had a huge network of food pantries. I will say, and I think Shannon said this herself, I've never met anyone receiving food assistance where that's their long-term aspiration. People
Right.
want to be self-sufficient. So what's wrong with a policy that intends to take people off of temporary assistance and move them to self-sufficiency?
Yeah, so I think just to put some context on the reality of what it means to be eligible for SNAP, Massachusetts, we have incredibly high shelter costs. We have incredibly high childcare costs. And the limits for SNAP are still incredibly low. You have to be very poor to qualify for a SNAP benefit in Massachusetts. And so the proposed rule would take something that's already very low and very difficult to be eligible for and make it even lower. And so families who in reality don't have any money left in their pocket at the end of the month to put towards that childcare, to put towards that rent cost, it would make those costs even more significant. And it would really eliminate the ability of families, working families who are in this trying to move out of poverty. It would really eliminate their connection to SNAP, which has much broader impacts. It has a really harmful impact on our local economies because it reduces the amount of money that is used in stores. We have 5,000 SNAP retailers in Massachusetts. This is a big deal. It would put 90,000 individuals at risk of losing SNAP across our state and 3.1 million across the country. So that's a big deal for retailers as well.
So Shannon, when you eventually transitioned off of SNAP into full economic self-sufficiency, how did that happen? What changed in your life that you became fully economically self-sufficient, if that's the way you would describe it?
I wish I could say it was the system. I wish I could say that they supported me in a way that gave me enough access to resources that I could pull myself out. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case. I kind of had to scrape and claw my way little by little by little, and I was fortunate in that I had come from a background. I'm well educated, and I had a master's degree. I had a career before, you know, I was in shelter, and so I had the advantage that I could at least figure out what was happening, what where the resources were, and that kind of thing. But it's a long process. I went into shelter in 2013, and I was there for 2 years. And then it took another 6 months after I started working to be able to finally transition out of the shelter into my own apartment. And at that point, I should have had, you know, a stabilization worker or somebody. I never met anybody. What? So I literally had to figure out for myself, and I cut corners here and there, and I didn't have internet for a long time, and I didn't have cable for a long time, and I had one phone line, one cell phone line for a long time. And so that's how I was able to get to a place where I could feel a little bit more stable. And I worked hard at my job. Yeah. And I decided to go back to school. And so those are some things that I did. And those weren't things that were encouraged by programs or by the system or by anyone who was supposed to be helping, you know, transition me into a place of self-sufficiency.
You really did that.
Those
were
things
own.
That I just figured out to do.
All right. So, Vicky, we've just heard that from Shannon. It doesn't sound like anyone's disputing that wanting to move to self-sufficiency is everybody's objective. It does sound like what you're saying is that this particular approach, so the policy objective may not necessarily be wrong, but that you're saying this policy proposal in particular isn't going to work. And
right.
We're hearing from Shannon, hey, I had to do a lot of this on my own and scrounge. And I had made some smart investments and I had to teeter on the edge for a long time. So, Vicky, what is a better way to ease people off SNAP? If what the USDA is proposing isn't the right way, then what is?
Yeah, I think that's a really good and a really important question. And I think that, you know, if the Trump administration really cared to make sure that low-wage working families were able to move forward in a way that was sustainable and long-term and ongoing, then you know, we would have more investment in jobs that had living wages and continuity of mm-hmm. hours. You know, we have a gig economy where folks, their hours go up, they go down on a regular basis. And it's very difficult to plan and have consistency when those hours fluctuate that much. We have a huge problem with access to affordable childcare. Certainly in mm-hmm. Massachusetts, that's a major issue.
We are one of the most, if not the most expensive state in the country for infant child care.
We have the second most expensive cost, yeah, for infant child care nationally. So again, there's an area where if we were serious about trying to tackle hunger and trying to tackle food insecurity and poverty, there are much better ways of doing it that don't involve taking food off of the table of tens of thousands of working families in our state.
So, Shannon, the public has 60 days to comment on this proposal, and that's until September 23rd. If you had an opportunity to provide feedback directly to Sonny Perdue, the head of the USDA, what would you tell him?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think what Vicky says is 100% true. I feel like the only way to really end hunger is to really take a holistic approach to lots of other determinants, education, jobs, careers, how much life skills a family has. So I really feel like structuring the system so that it answers all of these other issues. You know, there are so many barriers to an individual becoming self-sufficient, and it's not just about food, and it's not just about cash money. It's about resources, it's about education, it's about finding the right jobs and the right certifications and the right trainings, and providing people with financial literacy skills and making sure that they do have their child care in place and that kind of thing. So if it's not a holistic approach and it's not tackling all of these other factors of for food insecurity, then I don't really feel like we're really doing much of anything except continuing in the same vein.
Vicky, anything you'd add?
No, I want to echo everything that Shannon said. I mean, the costs of this kind of proposal are significant. Mm-hmm. It would increase food insecurity. It would also increase healthcare costs, right? We know that when people are food insecure, their health outcomes are worse. We know the Greater Boston Food Bank has done this great analysis of healthcare costs in our state. And in 2016, hunger in Massachusetts cost our state $2.4 billion with a B. And so increasing the number of people who are food insecure is not the way to solve any big problems.
That's Vicky Negus, who's a policy advocate with the Massachusetts Law Reform Institute. Vicky, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And we've been also joined on the line by Shannon Uramchuk, who serves on the board of the directors of the Food Bank of Western Massachusetts. Shannon, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.